show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, a Baseball Prospectus affiliate. Folks, we have a very, very special show that may involve some magic. So throwing that out there, we'll get to that in a second. But first, I, of course, am Jeff Hur. With me, as always, he is, despite what you've heard, he's not in the running to be the next head director of the FBI. But he is here as a host of this podcast, Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing on this? It's got a little bit better on the evening. It was the big storm that rolled through Kansas City. I don't know if you got it in Lawrence, but it's one of those things where it's like, oh, hey, the weather's nice today. And then you get to work and you look out the window and it's all crap. So, but it passed through and now things are okay. But
yeah, we didn't get a whole lot of that. There's a little bit of rain, but it wasn't quite as torrential as I kind of heard it might've been out in Kansas City. So I think we missed it. But and more importantly, hey, we're recording on your birthday.
Hey,
happy birthday!
That. Oh, thank you.
It's what greater gift than to talk about a team that's 8 games under 500?
I don't know of one, to be honest with you. It's what I always wanted.
I knew that.
Yeah, I'm glad that you could help make this happen here.
Yes.
And
wait, don't.
Don't put
don't
this
blame
on
me. Don't put that.
Speaking of
on
actually,
me.
Speaking of somebody who actually has helped make it happen, Salvador Perez and I share a birthday. So
there you go.
That's always fun.
Coincidence. So
happy birthday to Salvador Perez as well.
I think so.
Coincidence? Absolutely.
I don't think so, I have any baseball players on my birthday, so
I don't know. I'd have to
certainly no Royals, check. But.
What's your birthday?
September 7th.
September
something on the baseball
7th
reference.
Birthdays. We're going to look it up right now. Famous birthdays. Let's see. Eazy-E.
Okay.
He's not a baseball player, of course, but
he wore a baseball cap.
Kevin Love, basketball player.
I didn't know that. Okay.
There you go, Buddy Holly. Leslie Jones.
Oh, okay.
Let's see. Evan Rachel Wood.
All right.
Man, you got a lot on your birthday. You got some good ones here.
See, it used to never be that way. It used to be like Grandma Moses was the only one that I knew.
Corbin Burnson totally counts.
Oh, like there Roger you go. Rudder
Major
Dorn.
League. So that counts in my book.
That's as good as I think I can do.
Shannon Elizabeth, hey, there's that. I think right. That's all according to this particular website. But we'll go with Roger Dorn. We'll count that.
All right. Good enough. So, still, no Sal Perez. But
congratulations. Still no Sal Perez. No. Only one day of the year for that birthday.
Sure.
Now, we talked about a little bit of magic. Do you believe in magic, Mike? I got to ask you.
I don't. I do not.
No? No? Not a magic believer, are you?
I'm not. I do like the Harry Potter movies.
Would you say that any form of magic is mostly tricks and sleight of hand, possibly otherwise known as chicanery?
I think smoke and mirrors would apply as well.
As if you will.
I watched The Prestige last weekend. It was on Netflix.
Hey, I watched it too on Netflix. Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
I was just scrolling through looking for something, and I saw that. I was like, man, I'll watch this movie in forever.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. I was like, this movie is excellent, so I'm going to watch it. And And it was great. And that was my kind of magic. That's interesting. I liked it. It was a good movie.
Yeah.
But not a magic believer.
I always felt bad watching that movie because they show the trick at the beginning where he smashes the bird cage, but the bird still lives. And then, spoiler alert, later on in the movie, you find out that there's two birds and they're just literally killing one by smashing it with the cage.
Symbolic.
Really, really unfortunate. Symbolic of the current Royals, perhaps? I don't know, but...
I don't know. I don't think it applies. Well,
no.
No.
Not really.
No.
But one thing that does apply is people that do believe in magic believe in a hashtag Esky leadoff magic. So this was something that started in 2015 was when it really started, right?
It really started in 2015. I don't think people paid that much attention in 2014.
He had hit leadoff before 2015, but it wasn't the quote Esky leadoff magic. And then 2015 occurred late in the season. They switched him to leadoff and he was leadoff for all the playoffs. And of course he led off the World Series with an inside the park home run. And after that, the rest is history. It was some divine force that caused the Royals to win simply by batting one of the worst everyday hitters in the major leagues over the past 3 years in your first spot in the lineup. So
yeah,
there are people out there that believe this, that, you know, it works. And I shouldn't say believe, like, in the sense of, like, there's any supernatural force, but they believe that putting Esky in leadoff works and the team is better with Escobar in the leadoff spot. So it's interesting to look at it because there's a couple ways you can break it down, you know, and I feel like this, it's not directly this kind of stats versus anti-stats argument. It's not exactly the same camps, you know, but it's a similar type of argument where you have one side saying, okay, well, he's got like a 564 OPS or something that in that ballpark as a leadoff hitter for the Royals. You know, he hasn't done what you need a leadoff hitter to do, which is to say, get on base. And yet, then you've got the other camp that says, hey, whatever the stats are, let's look at the results. And you see the results, the statistic that's been bandied about here, apparently it was said on the broadcast by the Rays announcers last night being May the 9th, as we're recording on May 10th. But they said that the Royals record over since 2014 with Escobar batting leadoff was 105-59.
Yeah.
So it struck me as odd because that seemed well better.
That's a lot. That's two-thirds of the time that you're winning.
I mean, that would make you hands down the best team in all of baseball. That's a little bit more than a full season, but you know, it'd be 105-57 essentially. Not essentially. That's exactly what it would be for a full season. So I mean, you would be one of the best records of all time, really. So you know, that's quite impressive. But it's not actually true. I'm not sure where that statistic came from. I saw some people, you know, throwing it out on Twitter today, but not entirely accurate. You know, we went back and looked at everything, and I'm not sure if there's some sort of arbitrary endpoint that they were using that was different. But, you know, since 2014, so 2014, 15, 16, and then even counting the last couple games that he's been moved back into the leadoff spot, the Royals are 132-98 is the record that we came up with. Now, while I'm not as good as that original one, that's still pretty damn good.
It's still pretty good, yeah.
You know, you would take that. That's, what was it, a 57 winning percentage-ish?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you would take that over the course of a season, right? Because what is that? 85, 87 wins? Let's see the math.
I got the math here.
I got a calculator. I'm an accountant.
About 91 wins.
Is it really that high?
Yeah.
It is. You're right. Let's see.
I would take that if I could get that percentage guaranteed. Absolutely.
Yes, I would certainly take that. So that's pretty cool, you know, that the Rose have done well in that. But it's a matter of, you know, are we looking at the right things here? Are we looking at it and saying, okay, Escobar is providing some modicum amount of value at the leadoff spot that he is not able to provide anywhere else that tips the scales in the Royals' favor? Now, you look, the Royals are 2-0 in the last two games that Esky's been hitting leadoff. And you look, I should have had this pulled up, but I'm going to pull up the his stats for the last two games. You don't happen to have those up, do you?
As of his second at bat, he was 2-for-12 and had scored one run out of their 14.
In those two games?
In the last two games, yes.
There you go. So
one of 14 runs scored. He'd been on base twice. So
in two games, mind you. And,
yeah.
And
yeah.
So once per game and on average. And then, you know, that which game did he score the run in?
I did not write that down, but.
Okay. No big deal. But, you know, last night, Royals win 7-6. Excuse me. In was it 11 innings?
Oh yeah, he was. He was 2-for-5. He got hits in his first two at bats on Monday, and it seemed like he got a single, then a double, and everybody was joking that it was going to go hit for the cycle. Now that he was leading off, so he was 0-for-5 yesterday. He scored and was 2-for-5 the day before, and he was 0-for-2 as soon as we started recording. So. That's where he was.
So 2-for-12 with one run, and the one run was on.
It was on Monday.
On Monday, yes. So last night in a 12-inning game that the Rose win 7-6, he doesn't even score. He doesn't get on base. He doesn't score, and yet the Royals still put up seven runs and win. And, you know, last night's game, I wasn't able to see the whole thing. I went out to dinner. That's actually my mother-in-law's birthday was yesterday, so we did like a joint dinner last night. Anyway, so the Royals, it felt like that kind of 2015 Royals. You know, they got down early. Things were not looking good. But then they slowly, you know, just kind of chipped away at it, and then, you know, run here, run there. And next thing you know, they tie it up, go into extra innings, get to the 12th. Mike Moustakas hits a home run. It feels like the playoffs again. It feels like the playoffs again. Mike Moustakas, the home run hero.
Home run on the road.
That's right. Was that his ninth home run of the season?
It was his eighth.
Eighth?
Yep.
So since we're here, we can do a...
quick Balboni Chase.
Quick, update. Yep, exactly. Balboni Chase update, ladies and gentlemen. So, let's see. Today is May the 10th, and we are 33 games into the season. And Mike Moustakas has 8 home runs. So, let's check out Steve Balboni. God damn, he is one sexy man, isn't he?
You know, the Franciscan monks are really, really jealous of his hairstyle.
I can only imagine.
I don't know if I have the right tonsure described there. There's Benedictine monks and Franciscan monks, and they.
I think you're right, Franciscan.
I'm not sure. I'm not. It's been a while since I've thought about monk tonsure in relation to Steve Balboni's hair.
Yes. Now, so let's see.
Which implies that I've thought about it before.
Yes.
I have.
So as of May 8th or May 10th, but let's see, that was 26 games in 1985. So by the 33rd game, let's see, he had, where are the home runs? See, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So Mike Moustakas is 33% of the way ahead of Steve Balboni in the Balboni chase, folks.
He should be on base for about 40, give or take.
Yeah, let's see. 33 games was 5, 4. Yeah, because that's exactly
about 1/5.
Wait. Yes, you're right. 1/5, almost exactly. So, yeah. So on pace for 40. So let me make sure I didn't miss one here. Let's count one. Let's just go like this. Okay. 33 games, and I like this aggregate. I love this thing that Baseball Reference has, but seven. I did miss one. Seven home runs.
Seven.
33 games.
Okay, so he's ahead. So,
and that 85 team was 18-15, in case you're curious.
That seems better than 12-20.
It seems that way. But let me tell you something about that 1985 team. They may have won a World Series.
They did not have Alcides Escobar batting leadoff.
Damn straight. You done read my mind. So, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
Anyway,
I think the whole thing, so much is made of this Esky magic. And when the Royals were struggling, I got so many people saying, well, let's just hit him. Let's just hit him at the top of the lineup. What's it going to hurt? I'm like, okay, think about it. He's, you know, his career on base percentage is .295. It's just, you're asking that guy to get the most at bats of anybody over a stretch. It's not a logical way to go. I mean, I guess that's why you have to call it magic. But so much of that record of that you know, favorable record with him leading off comes from 2015, and that team really won in spite of him hitting leadoff more than anything. You had a career year from Lorenzo Cain. You had a strong year from Gordon. You had one of Hosmer's best years. You had a career year from Mike Moustakas. Later, you had Ben Zobrist in the lineup.
Kendrys Morales
was strong. Sal Perez hit 20 homers. You know, you had, it's, you almost would have to actively try to screw it up by batting someone terrible leadoff, and it still didn't work. So I that's what frustrates me, is when the superstition, and I don't think a lot of people think that it's some, like, you know, there's a lot of superstition. People want to do their good luck thing. I know a lot of times people will change shirts, or they'll, you know, they'll do things the same way they did, you know, the game before or whatever. I get it. That's fine. If you like doing that, that's cool. But when we're talking about really thinking about, okay, is this a smart idea? Probably trying to find some kind of good luck charm is not the best strategy for a team to make. Now, Yost does it, and they score 7 in consecutive games, and they win 2. And, well, it looks like...
And we look like idiots.
Oh, yeah, and you knew it was going to happen, too.
Of course.
But even with all of that, you would think that, okay, well, maybe Escobar does hit better when he's hitting leadoff, but his career line batting leadoff since 2014 is .260, .293, with a .321 slugging, which is basically his career line. So he doesn't change at all because he's batting leadoff. And if he's not changing at all, it means he's not getting on base any better. He's not slugging any better. So there's not really any improvement. You're just putting in a guy who's going to make an out 70% of the time at the top of your lineup. And the Royals, you know, they managed to win despite that. I mean, last year they were 39-43 when he was leading off, you know, which is basically, they were an 81-81 team. So more or less, they pretty much were about the same team with him leading off as not. So there's no logical argument for it. It's just got to be that they happened to win those games while he happened to be leading off. It's kind of like the stat that Chris Young was had pitched in losing games 13 straight times, mm-hmm. which would suggest, oh, dang, Chris Young is always, you know, always losing games. Well, no, he this year especially, he came into one tie game and one game where the Royals trailed by two, and the rest were larger deficits than that. So he came in and the game was already gone. You know, his role was that he's pitching when it's already a loss. It's not that they lost because he pitched. It's he pitched because they lost. And I think that's kind of the thing at play here. It just bugs me. It shouldn't bug me that something like Esky Magic gets going. You know, because to some extent it's just having fun with the fact that the Royals probably, maybe they feel looser and they play better because of it. And maybe that's something to it. But that's not something I think you can rely on. And when you're playing every day for 6 months, you need to have something that you can rely on. And I think having you know, good luck charm at the top of the order is not probably the direction that you should be going. So no, I don't believe in magic. I do not. I don't think that there are angels in the outfield. I don't think that Dumbo flew because he had a magic feather. You know,
because he had big ears and updrafts.
Yes, right. It was aerodynamics. Well, and wind resistance.
The thing that's so interesting to me is, I think there's a large contingent of people that are on the, you know, Esky lit off magic side of the argument. And they will say that, you know, Escobar or someone like Alex Gordon, you know, there was a lot of people, you know, he's been struggling the last year and a half or so, but when he was really going well, you know, in that 2011-2015 timeframe, a lot of people were saying, you know what, he's actually numbers wise, he fits the role of being a leadoff hitter, mm-hmm. you know, because he gets on base and all that kind of stuff. And then you have people that say, you know, that just be like, oh, Alex Gordon, he's not a leadoff hitter. Like, well, you know, he does what a leadoff hitter needs to do. It's like, no, he's not a leadoff hitter. You know, he's not, you know, and you see a lot of radio hosts too that have made this kind of argument, at least not in terms of necessarily saying Alex Gordon is not a leadoff hitter, but saying what a leadoff hitter should be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of it is Alcides Escobar looks like your prototypical, like, 1970s leadoff hitter. You
right,
know?
The Ozzie slight, Smith type.
Exactly. Doesn't have a lot of power, hits a lot of ground balls, a lot of speed, can beat out some grounders, can steal some bases. It's like once he's on the base paths, you know, then it's an advantage. And Alcides Escobar has always been a pretty solid base runner. So, you know, once he's on, it's definitely an advantage. But it's getting him there. That's the problem. So yeah,
he can't steal first.
And on the one hand, you say, oh, well, there's all these things that a leadoff hitter should be and have, you know, good bat speed and good bat control and all that kind of stuff. And you want those things because those typically are traits of hitters that are able to get on base quite frequently. Mm. But it's almost like there's this weird disconnect, you know, where like you – there's all these things that people recognize that a base or a leadoff hitter should have, but then when it comes to looking at the numbers, there's not as much credence placed on that because of, you know, oh, well, I know the skill set they need to have. The numbers just kind of work themselves out or whatever. You know, it's not necessarily entirely true. There's a little bit more of an interrelationship there, but it's just that kind of dynamic in this situation has always been interesting to me. Like, why? I just never see the logic behind not wanting to have someone in your leadoff spot who gets on base the most out of your team. Like, it's tough for me to logically put myself through the steps of saying that Alcides Escobar is more valuable in those slots. Now, the ultimate argument against my saying I don't see the logic is, well, look at their record. They're 132 and 98, in the last 2.5 years. So it's like, well, I mean, I guess I don't really know how to argue with that. You know, I don't.
You can't. When it's results based, no, it's.
Yeah. It's tough. You know, it's like, you know, for the longest time, Ford Motor Company, right? I remember when I was in college, we studied this in my statistics class. For the longest time, Ford Motor Company was the number one car manufacturer in the world. They made tons and tons of money, and people bought their cars, and it was no big deal, you know. But their processes were not efficient, and they were not good. They were making crappy cars, but there was, you know, less of an alternative, and so on and so forth. Eventually, hey, this Toyota company from Japan makes way better cars, and so, you know, Ford took a huge downturn because they didn't make the right their cars weren't as good. The problem was they were blinded to it because their results, they were making lots of money, they were selling lots of cars, so they didn't feel the need to change, you know. So when you're what you just said, you know, about when it's results based, you know, when you're looking at, okay, they win games, no need to change, it's like, if your team is so good, like the 2015 Royals were, that you can win that many games with someone who's essentially just a black hole in your leadoff spot, you know, that just shows you how good the Royals were. That doesn't necessarily show you anything about, you know, what Alcides Escobar brings to the table as a leadoff hitter. So, you know, and again, to play devil's advocate to myself, the ultimate flip side of that, again, besides results-based thinking, is that, you know, baseball is a very mental game. There's a lot of mental preparation. We've talked about how the Royals have really stressed that as an organization, being mentally strong, being able to handle all that kind of stuff, and they prepare their players. Sure, they try to prepare their players as best they can mentally. So the mental aspect of the team, I mean, there was a quote from Ned Yost, saying that the team was excited. Alcides Escobar, he just writes him in. I imagine everyone sitting there like, do it, do it, do it. It's like chanting as Ned Yost finally writes Alcides Escobar, and then they like hoist him up on their shoulders, and Esky's in leadoff, you know. But he said the team was excited. It's excited about Alcides Escobar leading off, you know. And so if that's probably the best argument that you could have. If you want to say, you know what, if Ned Yost is like, you know what, fuck it. The team wants Escobar there. He may not be the best, but if I can jumpstart these guys' psyche by putting, you know, someone in the leadoff spot, so be it. I will do that, and it, you know, things will be okay. But that's probably your best argument, that it helps the mental state of the team. And, you know, I guess I'm okay with that if that's where it is. But then you're talking about, you're still talking about helping the mental state of the team to get to the point where they can be so much better than they were that they overcome what Escobar brings, which is to right. say doesn't bring to the leadoff spot. So I don't know. I mean, when you have those results, it's kind of like, well, you know, what can you say, I guess? But at the same time, you know, we've always talked about on this show, even, you know, ever since, you know, we've had the show, we've talked about, you know, really stressing process-based thinking, kind of weird baseball things. As Hunter Samuels said today on Twitter, I saw, you know, it's just a fun baseball thing, and that's all it needs to be. So, you know, as long as, you know, don't want, you know, take it too seriously. Like there's, you know, some sort of something that, you know, Escobar is a legitimately good leadoff hitter, because he's not.
He is not. No.
No. So I don't know. It's interesting to me.
Yeah, I think the main benefit you would get is the more managerial side, like traditional managerial, like everyday, you know, regular people managerial, of picking up your team and making them, you know, giving them some kind of a morale boost sure, I can buy into that. How long does that last? I mean, I don't know. If it lasts for a week, that's great. But then there's going to be struggles. And I think most any lineup is going to be optimized by getting the guys who would generally get on base most in descending order from best to last. More or less, you're probably going to score more runs that way than you are with somebody leading off because you think they play better when he's leading off. I mean, it just, that's how it is. When you're looking at over the course of a full season, that first spot in the lineup will get, say, 20 more at-bats than the second spot in the lineup and 20 more than the next and the next and the next. And so when you're talking about Escobar, who's a guy who should be hitting like eighth or ninth, you're giving him a lot of extra at-bats that he really doesn't have the profile to justify. And, you know, if you're giving him 80 more at-bats per year, he's just going to make an out 70% of the time, where the alternative would be somebody like a Gordon or even in a couple games this year, like a Moustakas, where they sure don't look the part, but they're guys who can take pitches and get on base, and maybe they lead off with a home run with nobody on, but they have that capability to hit that home run. And you see that now with guys like Carlos Santana in Cleveland and Kyle Schwarber in Chicago, who would definitely not be mistaken for the typical Juan Pierre, Gerard Dyson, Alcides Escobar kind of scrappy, fast leadoff guy, because those guys get on base and they hit well, and you're starting off the game with somebody who has, you know, 37% chance of getting on base versus someone who has a 29-30% chance. And so, you know, logically, that's where I have to approach it, even if it is a little bit of fun. You know, it's a long-term game. And if you believe in magic, well, all right, fine.
Go on believing.
But
if I may offer one counterpoint, this just came to me.
Okay.
If you're Ned Yost,
yeah,
perhaps you think it's actually an advantage to have Escobar being on base left. Hear me out. Because the more he's on base, the greater likelihood that Eric Hosmer grounds into a double play.
There's an argument there.
Am I wrong?
Lead off Eric Hosmer.
There you go.
He can't hit into a double play if he's the only batter in the game so far.
Hashtag guy pointing to his head. Meme.
Mm-hmm. I'm doing that literally right here at the table. Can't do that.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's interesting. It's quite astounding, the record, actually, when you look at it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't be the first time I'd be wrong. Could be one of those fluky things, you know. It's just, hey,
if they want to go win 80 games from now on, I'm fine with that, but I just don't see it happening.
No, as they're losing, as we record this, they're losing 7-0.
With Escobar leading off.
That Esky leadoff magic picks its spots, I suppose.
I guess. They kind of stole yesterday's game, so I guess that's okay.
Yeah. Who knows? Maybe they'll start chipping away, but I doubt it. Anyway.
I doubt it.
I think we'll take a break. We'll take a small break, and then we'll come back. The Royals have made some transactional maneuvers and some roster changes that have happened this week. So take a quick break. We'll discuss those when we get back. Stick with us, and we'll see you on the other side.
The Kansas City Baseball Vault will be right back after these messages.
We're where you want to be. Baseball with the Royals.
The Vault.
Every town has a place where elites gather for witty conversations over trendy cocktails. In Kansas City, that place is definitely not Kelly's Westport Inn. From its humble beginnings at the corner of Westport Road and Pennsylvania Avenue, Kelly's Westport Inn has seen it all. Pioneer wagon trains filled with families heading west, Civil War battles, and Major League Baseball championships. Kelly's is born of history and tradition, and we hope you'll allow us to become part of your history and traditions as well. Kelly's Westport Inn, 500 Westport Road, Kansas City, Missouri.
City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, a Baseball Prospectus affiliate. So, first part of the show, we talked about some Esky leadoff magic. Do you believe in magic? That's up for you to decide. Now, since as the Royals, you know, the season continues to march onward, and they're shifting the lineup changes, some of it to get that Esky leadoff magic, but some of it also is a necessity. There's been some injuries. There's been some lack of performance, some roster shifts. Mike, why don't we give the listeners a breakdown of the moves that have happened this week, and then we can kind of discuss about some of the implications for the team.
Okay. Well, Ian Kennedy went on the disabled list. We talked about that briefly last time, but shortly after, Scott Alexander, who had been pitching very well and actually had earned himself a spot as kind of a setup guy, he went on the DL. He had a strained hamstring. He was running sprints and got hurt. And it sounds like maybe like 2 or 3 weeks for him to kind of miss some action, which is unfortunate because, you know, he had so many struggles last year after, you know, he was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And, you know, that was something that once he figured it out, he pitched better. But there were a lot of times where he had to overcome that and not really know what the problem was. You know, now he gets over that, has a really good spring, comes in, gets called up, pitches well for the Royals in some pretty big spots. And now he's hurt and it kind of slows him up again. So that was one move. They sent him to the disabled list, called up Jake Junis the other day. But then today, you know, the Royals, they've gone through the last few games where, you know, Joaquin Soria and Kelvin Herrera have worked, you know, 3 out of 4, 4 out of 5 days and quite a lot. And they leaned on Travis Wood for some relief innings yesterday. Chris Young made a spot start, went about 3 innings. They had an extra inning game. Mike Minor had to cover a couple innings. So the bullpen could use a rest. The Royals needed to add to the bullpen, especially with, you know, Alexander being out and not being available. So they had to add two guys who were not on the 40-man roster. They called up Al Albuquerque, who was a minor league signing. And we know him with, you know, so many years in Detroit.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. He'd been pitching pretty well in Omaha, 13.2 innings pitched, 12 strikeouts, 4 walks, 2.63 ERA. They called up Seth Maness, who we talked about during spring training as an interesting name because, you know, he had arm surgery. He had elbow surgery not even like 9 months ago for a torn UCL that they were able to repair with a new technique. Now he's back in the big leagues, 9 months.
Yeah, that's quite impressive.
Pretty remarkable. He threw 6 innings, 5 strikeouts, and 1 walk for Omaha. He's always been a good control guy who can get ground balls. So I think he's got a good shot to do some stuff. But, you know, those names are interesting. But the really interesting names are the guys that had to leave the 40-man roster to make room. And the first one is Peter O'Brien, who was spring training legend.
Spring training legend.
And, you know, I don't think we expected to see him get designated for assignment so early, but he's not hitting. He's hitting 162 with a 235 on base, 276 slugging in Omaha. and you know, a lot of the same problems that have plagued him throughout his career. You know, lack of contact. You know, he's all or nothing basically with the home run ball. Still doesn't really have a defensive position. He's 27 years old, so that clock is ticking. So it, you know, the Royals having a lot of other corner outfield type of guys and a lot of like first base guys in their organization who have been playing well. You know, it just he seemed like someone who could, you know, if they can sneak him through waivers, great. But more or less, he's, you know, he's designated for assignment. Anybody can go claim him, or the Royals may trade him, or there may even just be a flat-out release. But the other, the biggest name in this, and the one that kind of, I don't know, I think a lot of people were shaken up a little bit by, was that Christian Colon was designated for assignment. And, you know, that's...
There's been some consternation on Twitter about this.
There has. And, you know, a lot of people want Colon to be the everyday second baseman. And he had a very good shot at that in spring training and played well and came in great shape. But, you know, Raul Mondesi got the first shot and they wanted to make a change. They went with Whit Merrifield, and he had been playing well in Omaha, and Colon was kind of stuck on the bench and hadn't really done a lot. He'd, you know, 19 plate appearances all season long, and we're here, you know, about, you know, 5-6 weeks into the season. So he's getting three or so plate appearances a week. It's just not enough to do anything, and he only had three hits total, so just wasn't doing much there. You know, so the Royals designated him for assignment. He could possibly clear waivers. I think there could be some teams who may be rebuilding who would take him on, just because, you know, what the heck, he's got some playoff experience. He's, you know, I think he could probably play somewhere every day, but the Royals were probably not going to give him that opportunity. You know, hit 263, 323 on base, 329 slugging in his career with the Royals at the big league level. You know, not great, but, you know, it's not overmatched. And then, you know, obviously for a lot of people, he's got those postseason memories as, you know, the game-winning run in the wild card game and had the game-winning hit in game 5 of the World Series. So I think that's what has people kind of shaken up, along with just kind of the idea that this is someone who's, you know, fourth overall draft pick back in 2010. And, you know, I think a lot of, you know, unreached expectations for him. He's always linked with Chris Sale as from that draft. Yes. And, you know, so there's a lot going on with this Colon move. And, you know, it was kind of surprising to see it happen, but in a lot of ways, not really. So
exactly.
It's like
one of those,
get it. You know, I don't think there was a great difference between choosing him or Merrifield, really. I mean, they're both, you know, I like both. But I'm not going to sit here and try to convince you that Whit Merrifield is an all-star. I think he's a guy who can probably fill in capably at the bottom of a batting lineup, play an okay enough second base, and he's really versatile. You know, Christian Colon has a little bit of versatility. He can make some contact. He's probably a fine enough fill-in, too. Neither of them long-term options. Neither of them with a lot of upside. You know, Merrifield has generally played better, and I think that's what won out. And Colon probably has an opportunity to go somewhere else before, you know, the next week is over. So that's, you know, that's kind of it. But it's still, those are some big names that we heard a lot about and we talked a lot about on this show over spring training who are now no longer on the 40-man roster. And we'll have to see, you know, probably by the time we record the next show, their status will be resolved one way or another, and we'll see where they land. But yeah, it was a pretty big move this afternoon.
Yeah, and with Colon, you know, it's important to note, I think, you know, there was always kind of talk that his attitude wasn't necessarily the best, and that, you know, maybe didn't necessarily put in the effort that he should have. So, you know, it's not as though Cologne was always this just like superstar in the making. You know, never close. It was always he was the high floor, low ceiling type of player, and that's what he was supposed to be. You know, and he didn't even turn into that. So you're looking at a guy, and when you're competing with a Whit Merrifield, who's essentially a career minor leaguer, and you don't even necessarily win out, you know, it's like you described it the best. It's surprising, but it's also not surprising. You know, I think maybe the timing maybe a little surprising, I guess, just because I don't know when there's really a good time for it. But just the fact that, you know, if you would have said, you know, a year ago, Christian Colon won't be on the Royals to start the 2018 season, you'd probably be like, yeah, it seems about right. You know, yeah, something will happen.
I can see that, yeah.
And, you know, unfortunately, not unfortunately, but, you know, he's kind of got a, he hasn't reached like full on irrational fandom status for Kansas City, but there's a little bit of it going on. You know, he scored the winning run in the wild card game in 2014. He had the game winning hit RBI for the game five of the World Series 2015, you know, so two huge plays that will never, ever be forgotten by any Royals fan. And he's a part of it forever, you know, talking history in terms of, you know, the wild card game is one of the best wild card games ever. So, you know, that will never be gone, will never be forgotten. So, you know, thanks to Christian Colon for those two scenarios. You know, but outside of that, you know, there hasn't been much. Yeah. And, you know, what are you going to do? It's, you know, and the Chris Sale comparison, or not comparison, but always kind of talking with Chris Sale, it's one thing to always take a, like I remember, was it Tim Lincecum was in the same, was it same draft as Alex Gordon?
Am I thinking of that right?
Hochaver, yeah. the year later, right? So, you know, but there was never really talk of the Royals drafting Tim Lincecum instead of Luke Hochaver that I recall. I was in college. I didn't follow the draft, the baseball draft, quite like I do now. Not even that I still follow it that closely now either. But, you know, in 2010, there was some discussion at least and lots of rumors and things flying about that the Royals actually would draft Chris Sale where they drafted Christian Colon. You know, that was a discussion. There was a lot of links to Chris Sale and the Royals. So, you know, it feels a little bit more relevant for that reason. But again, that's kind of just an aside to that point. It's nothing really to do with Christian Colon being DFA'd right now. But
he'll never escape that. It's just one of those things that, you know, it's always going to be a matter of disappointment that he was never a guy who justified not taking Chris Sale. You know, I mean, the Royals could have taken Yasmani Grandal in that draft. I remember there were reports that there was an agreement in place for them to take him. And really it was one of those drafts where, you know, other than Sale, there weren't a lot of, you know, really huge mega hits. I mean, it was Harper, Gerrit Cole, and Manny Machado in the top three. And then the Royals were fourth. And, you know, Chris Sale was like the next best player who has come out of that draft, but you know, there's just not a lot. You know, the Royals were kind of.
I think that was that Jameson Taillon? I thought was that
maybe that was it.
Because I think Gerrit Cole was the same year as Trevor Bauer, right? Cole was the number one pick.
Oh, I think you're right.
Next year,
I think you're right. Yeah, yeah. I think.
But anyway, I mean, not super important, but
yeah,
just
a Pirates pitcher.
Yes. I do remember that was kind of like the one position you didn't want to be in was the fourth pick in the draft.
Yeah.
Cause there were three legitimate talents who all turned out to be, you know, Taillon's had some some issues, but Bryce Harper has been as advertised as has Manny Machado. So, you know, those were clear cut, the, you know, future superstars in the draft. And then the rest was just kind of like, well, you know, Christian Colon was going to be a fast mover and a high floor and none of those things. I mean, if you would have said in 2010 that Christian Colon would score the winning run in a wild card game and would knock in the game-winning RBI to clinch a World Series title, you'd be like, okay, this totally makes sense. Yeah. Yes.
I love this pick. You know,
this is so great.
How many All-Star games did he make?
Yeah, exactly. You know, how many – oh, I bet he hit, you know, 320 home runs and –
yeah, if he could have been Jose Altuve, that would have been great, but not everybody's Jose Altuve.
No. Very few. Most people are half Jose. Twice. I'm trying to make a short joke here. It's not happening, but you get what I'm saying. He's a short player, but he's very good.
Yeah.
So how many Altuves is Christian Colon? I don't know.
Well, he's not much bigger. He's maybe 4 inches taller than Altuve.
Not much taller.
Well, yeah. Yeah, true.
Anyway, so, you know, Christian Colon, unfortunate. I do think, like you alluded to, I think there's a chance that he probably sneaks through and they just outright him to Omaha anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know that there's many teams clamoring for him. And, you know, it'd be one thing if he was Chris Getz, let's say. Right. Ugh. Where, you know, if you were a young team in a rebuilding mode, you know, and you just needed somebody to stick in to second base with good experience, you know, Chris Getz kind of would fit that mold. He played a lot of games there. You know, he's a veteran, that kind of a thing. But Christian Colon doesn't have a ton of major league experience, really, you know. I mean, so it's not like he's some huge veteran guy who's just got a ton of experience and could be a good locker room presence and just give you consistency at the position for, you know, while you wait for something else to happen. You know, so he doesn't even provide that. So because of that, I think there's a, you know, that just increases the odds that the Royals will just be able to send him back to Omaha anyway. So, you know, this all might be a moot point, but.
Right. Yeah. Everybody who was wishing him, you know, best wishes is going to be seeing him in 3 weeks anyway. So.
Yeah. It's kind of like there's this guy that I started with at my job, or he was already working at my current job when I started. And I kind of – the role I have now is kind of the role that he was when I started. And he left the company to do a career change to go be a teacher, right? So
well, I was – anyway.
Yeah, but he – but, you know, teachers have the summers off. So, you know, a lot of teachers will get jobs in the summer or whatever. And sometimes we'll have a lot of work and we'll need temp work. So – you know, he's come back to work a couple times, and you know, he worked for, you know, 7-8 years before I started, so everyone knew him really well. You know, we had like a going away party when he left, and then, you know, he's come back, and then like a couple summers he's come back to work and had a couple, so we've had a couple more going away parties. So that's kind of what came to mind when you described that. It's like, oh, we're going to miss you. That's such a great hit in that World Series. Remember that one time?
Bye.
And so awesome. Oh, you're back. Hey, glad to have you back, you know?
It's like when you walk out of a building, you say goodbye to whoever you're walking with, and you both start walking the same direction.
Oh, exactly. It's like, yep. All right, see you tomorrow.
Yep.
You're like parked right next to each other. Like, oh.
Hey, do we have to continue to talk?
No. Yeah, can we just pretend like we're walking in different directions?
Yeah, when you
start the floor?
You bring up that job thing, it reminds me when I used to work at Borders, and in March of 2010, I was, you know, they were going through a lot of financial problems, and I got laid off. My position was eliminated, and then like 5 months later, I ended up going back there to work basically full time hours at like a dollar less of my hourly rate, just because, you know, nothing else panned out up to that point. So it was like, okay, yeah, so Here I am. I'm back.
Hey.
Sup.
What's going on? Remember me?
Yeah. By that time, they'd had a lot of new part-timers, so they didn't really know who the heck I was.
Yeah.
So it was kind of weird, but anyway, it's that kind of thing, and I think there's a good chance he does. He procedurally, you know, he doesn't have enough service time to decline an outright assignment. So if he does clear waivers, the Royals can outright him to Omaha, keep him in the system, keep the inventory. If they were to call him up, they would need to clear another 40-man spot to re-add him to the 40-man roster. If then they needed to designate him for assignment again, he could refuse the second outright assignment. So they don't really get the chance to, you know, just jerk him around up and down. It's, you know, the union is kind of looked out for guys who that happens to. It's kind of like when, you know, guys like Adam Rosales, who a couple of years ago went from Oakland and then was designated, and Texas claimed him, and then he was designated for assignment, and then Oakland claimed him again, and then it went back and forth for like 3 weeks, and he just changed back and forth from the A's to Rangers like four times each, because, you know, they couldn't outright him at that point. So procedurally, yeah, there's a good chance Colon could stick, but if they do have to designate him again later, then, you know, he becomes a free agent and can explore whatever opportunities may be out there. So we'll see. I would guess 50-50 that he can clear and get outrighted, if I were to guess. It just takes one team to claim him, and if they have anything of depth to trade for him, then, you know, there you go. It'd probably be a player to be named later or cash trade or something at this stage. But, you know, I mean, we'll see. They have 10 days to decide. So by the time, those things usually resolve themselves within a few days. So we'll see. We'll have to report back next week, I guess.
Yes. And probably bigger news of all the transactions. You mentioned Ian Kennedy going to the disabled list. We already had a start from Chris Young last night. Didn't go so well. And Ned Yost said that for another spot start, I think the anticipation is, I mean, what'd you say? The 2 to 3 weeks is kind of what their people are thinking.
That's
for
what
the injury.
It sounded like for Alexander, but the last time.
Oh, you said that for Alexander.
Yeah. The last time that Kennedy had a hamstring issue, though, which is what he had this time. He missed three starts. So the Royals initially felt, they sounded like they thought he'd only miss one start. But, you know, if they're thinking Chris Young, then it's probably not going to be ready for his next turn. So, you know, it might be another one of those where he misses two or three starts. So, yeah, we'll see.
I mean, because Yost is saying that he's more confident that Chris Young's for another spot start, Young would do better because it would be at Kauffman Stadium for that particular start. I mean, I suppose there's some validity to that, but I don't know that I feel good about Chris Young starting really in any circumstance. So
no, and I didn't
Kauffman or no.
Right. I mean, he had plenty of bad games at Kauffman last year. So, I don't know. I didn't get to see last night's start. I got to see, like, the last half of it. But it also sounded kind of like some stuff was just kind of blooping through. I mean, other than Logan Morrison, who hit an absolute bomb off of him. Can't deny that. But it was like an infield single, then a big bomb, then some bloops and things that hit off people's gloves. And I'm just like, I'm not going to rip him too hard. But at the same time, you know, he's not an overpowering guy. He's not necessarily a control freak of, you know, who doesn't walk anybody. He can give up contact, and he does give up home runs. So, you know, a lot of the issues that he's had, you know, they're not going away. They're probably not going away anytime soon. And a lot of people thought that when the Seth Maness news was coming out today that Young was going to be designated for assignment himself. And, you know, maybe he's got one more start in him. Maybe he just continues to be that mop-up guy at the back of the bullpen. But you know, he's getting another start. It doesn't inspire confidence, even if I think that maybe some of the hits were a little iffy. I don't know. I mean,
yeah, I mean, I wasn't.
It's not ideal.
I wasn't super confident before yesterday. And yeah, even right. though there's some flukiness in there, I don't know that I'm all that confident. It didn't. Yesterday's performance didn't do anything to increase my confidence level.
Sure.
So Ned Yost and I differ in that regard. But, you know, hopefully Kennedy can come back. And he was having, you know, pretty nice season so far. And he's kind of a somewhat – he and Duffy had been kind of the stabilizing forces in the lineup, you know. And there's I saw on Twitter, I think it was Rustin Dodd had asked Ned Yost about, you know, Mike Minor, and who's been, you know, doing decently well in the minors. And I think they had said that I believe Yost's comment was that he was still concerned about pushing him out too far and what the stress on the shoulder would be. So he didn't want to, you know, throw him into a starting role right there. But he also said Travis Wood is a possibility. So, which I don't think we want to go there, but
I don't want to go there. No. Pass.
Hard pass.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And by then you'd, cause Junis would have to be down 10 days before they could recall him. I wouldn't mind seeing him pitch. I don't know that he's going to be necessarily better than either of those guys, but I'm willing to kind of look at it. Let's see, today's the 10th, so that would, yeah, I think you would still end up with, you'd still have to have one more start. If Kennedy missed a third, I think Junis could come back for that.
Yeah, I mean, Junis, in this scenario, it's almost like a perfect moment to what the Royals are in, because the Royals are out of it, and I think we pretty much know that. You know, it's going to take a lot for them to get back in, and in terms of a playoff race or a division race, but the Royals as an organization think they're still competing for that, or at least they're trying to put on that front. Mm-hmm. However, you can still, in this situation, being, you know, 8 games below .500, not being performing all that well, but having Kennedy, you know, not be out for the season or anything. So it's not like you're just handing the role over to somebody like a Junis, but since Kennedy has missing a couple starts, you can kind of let him get his feet wet, come up, make a spot start. Just like you said, just see what he's got. You know, I mean, you're at the point now where you've got to have that eye towards the future. You should have had it anyway, even if the Royals were reversed and they were 20-12 right now, you know, you would still need to have that eye towards the future, with a little bit more focus on the present. But, you know, you can be a little bit more loose with it, I think, and you can say, we can give a spot start to younger. You know, Chris Young's not going to be around past this year. I don't, because he has an option, but they're not going to pick it up.
No.
And then, you know, Travis Wood, you know, none of these guys are really factoring into Royals' long term plans, but Jake Junis might. So when you've got an opportunity to, you know, at least get some exposure for him and in a starting role, and just, you know, roll it out there, see what happens, you know.
Yeah, you never know.
Yeah, I feel like that's something that an opportunity that you should take, but the Royals feel differently. Not the first time that the Royals and I have disagreed from an organizational standpoint. So won't be the last, I don't imagine.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't know why they wouldn't choose to go with Junis, but, you know, I don't work there, so I don't know. No. He has made 4 starts, pitched 23 innings for Omaha, 3.52 ERA, so perfectly passable. But I don't know. I mean, he'll probably have some starts later in the year, maybe. I don't know. We'll see, I suppose, but. Yeah, I'm kind of surprised to hear that they want to go with Young again, even though I think he's caught a little bad rap this year. I'm not going to sit here and argue that he's been good by any stretch. So, you know, I would rather Kennedy just be better and come back and pitch. Is that an option?
Yes.
Can we make that happen?
I, too, would rather such a thing. So, with that, I think pretty much hit all the major stuff. Is there anything else you think warrants conversation in regards to the Royals?
I think we can get over the, oh, my God, Soria's coming in. We're going to lose reaction that people
had
last year. Soria's kind of making guys look foolish half the time he's out there, and the other half he gets outs other ways. He's had like one bad appearance.
Yeah, the movement on his ball this year, it's been fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of fun to watch. He's, you know, he's still throwing that 92-93, but he's missing bats with it. You know, every now and then he throws that slow curve. He's got a little splitter changeup thing happening. And Dave Lesky has a cool piece on it on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City about, you know, Soria's pitch selection and movement and all of that. And Soria's been good. I mean, he's been better than good. He's been really good, which is better than good.
Yes, definitely. So agreed. We can put that narrative to bed, hopefully for the entire season, but certainly for the near future.
Yeah.
but, you know, Royals still kind of chugging along. It feels like those 2011, 2010, 11, 12 seasons where they weren't like truly terrible, not like 2005, you know, where it was just this awfulness, but where they can kind of keep their head above water. Maybe they win like, you know, 5 out of 9 or something like that, you know, where they're like, okay, well, things are okay. But then they'll have a losing streak, lose 8 in a row, but then no equivalent winning streak to wipe it out or to do better. And so eventually, if you just go, you know, a couple games, 500, over 500 for long stretches, and then lose 5 to 10 in a row, and then don't make up for it, you know, that's how you end up 70 and 90 or 71 and 91 or something like that. So, you know, that's the way it kind of feels like it's going right now, because they just haven't, you know, you win 2 straight games with Esky leadoff magic, and then now you're down 7-0 in the fourth inning. You know, it's just, they can't really seem to get it going for an extended period of time. So hopefully that changes and we can, you know, I mean, maybe today is just the one blip and they won 2 more and then they'll go rattle off 5 straight. And then we're talking 6 out of 7. And then, you know, then they're only 3 or 4 games below 500 and, you know, you can kind of pick away at it. But again, like we talked about last week, every game further along is one less game they have to try and make up the difference. So it's they got to start moving quick if they want to make a run at this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And they got to hit, and it's just not happening.
Nope.
Consistently, at least. They have been better the last.
And actually, one thing we didn't talk about, we don't need to talk about it too much, but don't look now. Eric Hosmer's leading the team in batting average.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talked about it on the show. I think there's been a lot of talk on Twitter. You know, I don't think it's any shock that Eric Hosmer was going to be the best offensive player on the Royals for an extended period of time at some point this season. So he's kicked it into gear. And, you know, and I heard Seren Petro, I think it was today or yesterday, I heard him say that I agree with, you know, that coming into this year, he thought, and I was of the same impression, that maybe Hosmer could put away those dry spell months that are so dry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you just, instead of having peak Hosmer and then when he goes into a slump, having it be, you know, 50% of what he is at his peak, maybe you've changed that and you're now 65, 70% of what you were. So it's still a slump, but you're not as bad. And the overall numbers would increase, but that's not what's going to happen. That's not what we know what Hosmer is now. I think that you know, all these kind of years, we've still been holding out hope that there was just this one kind of breakout thing he needed. And I don't think that's there anymore. I think it is. This is who he is. Hosmer is a guy who, when he is at his best, he's an elite hitter who can compete with a lot of hitters in baseball in terms of talent level. And when he's at his worst, he's not even a replacement level
player. Yeah, he's marketable. Doug Minkiewicz is what I called him at some point.
Yeah. I don't know that I've seen a player like him that just such
Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah, such wide swings, but that's who he is. So you gotta take it and you gotta understand that with him, and that's kinda how it goes. But hopefully this streak that he's on continues and goes much, much further into the season, and everyone else wakes up around him and it'll all be great again. But I'm not going to hold my breath.
No, that would be dangerous.
Yes, very, very much so.
It would not work very well.
No, but hopefully things trend in the right direction. But either way, we'll be back next week with more Kansas City Baseball Vault talking Royals baseball and whatever is big in the world of the Royals next week. So before we leave, though, be sure to visit our sponsors. Specifically, we'd like to mention Kelly's Block Party, of course. Every year they have it, day before Memorial Day. So May 28th, which is a Sunday, right? I had the date right, mm-hmm. May 28th. So that is a Sunday. The next Monday will be Memorial Day, of course. So Kelly's Block Party, always a good time. One of their signature events. Be sure to head down there and hit up Westport and visit Kelly's and one of our sponsors and tell them the baseball vault sent you.
Yep.
But it's always a good time. Always love to show some love to the sponsors. And as you mentioned, with bpkansascity.com, Dave Lusky's got a great article on there talking about Soria and his resurgence this year. And there's always great articles. Clint Scholes keeps you up to date on all the minor league things happening and just tons of great content from a lot of hashtag content from a lot of the great writers we have on the site. So be sure to visit bpkansascity.com and hit up Kelly's. Don't forget about that block party May 28th, day before Memorial Day. So with that, we will leave you. We'll be back next week, of course. Thank you all so much for listening. We couldn't do it without you. We love all you listeners. So thanks again for stopping by. We'll see you next week. Until then, as always, go Royals.
Thank you for listening to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can follow us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City at bpkansascity.com. You can follow BPKC on Twitter at bprokansascity. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, through Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you like. And if you have any questions, comments, or if you just want to say hi, send those emails to KansasCityBaseballVault@gmail.com.